Today is January 20th, and I'm back with Wang Shi in his office. Do you like Wang Shi or Shi Wang?
Doesn't matter.
Anyway, we're back in your office at the Burnham Institute for the second day of your Pew Scholars interview. And as always, I have a few follow-up questions after reviewing yesterday's tapes. So one of the things I was wondering was whether, when you were growing up in China, whether you had any kind of formal religious training.
Not at all.
Or any religious training at all.
No, not at all.
Okay.
Even though my mother went to a religious school in this Wuhan, in the city of Wuhan.
So, was it like a missionary school?
Yeah, that was before the 49 revolution.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
But since communists took over, basically no religion is allowed.
Right. Is that anything that you wish you had, or not?
Not really.
Not really.
Yeah.
Okay. That's okay.
Yeah. After I came here, we were invited a few times to some religious practices or gatherings, and we really didn't like what's going on there.
Okay. Do you think religion and science can coexist?
I think so. Religion, I think, even though I'm not into religion, I'm very much interested in philosophy and how people view lives and stuff. Or what do they consider to be happy and stuff like that. So I think I consider myself have some sort of faith. You can call that religion or you can call that philosophy. In terms of how I view life. So I came to that view by my own experience without reading so much about religion or philosophy. I came to some conclusions which I found sort of interesting and very true to me, and I thought this is such a simple idea, it must have been written down somewhere in the history books or philosophy books. And then indeed, it was written down 2,000 years ago by the Chinese philosopher.
Confucius?
Mengfucius. The Mengfucius.
Oh.
Kong and Meng are always stated together as two names. They're maybe Confucius more famous in the West. So things like that, I sort of figured them out by myself, and then I have my own way of thinking. Therefore, I do not really need to follow any religion, even though many religions probably have some common ideas as I had. So I think religion is helpful to people who don't really have their own thought in terms of viewing the world and life, and they need some guidance. And then religion can come in to really help them out in that fashion.
So what was the enlightenment that you had?
Well, that is based on my experience. Things have come to me the hard way. Basically, I have to pay the dues before I got something in return, got something good in return. So it never come as a total luck. Even if something comes in, maybe unexpected good things happen, but then we're soon followed by something bad. So it always goes like this. But luckily the turn has been always going, moving up, mm-hmm. but it's like this. So I concluded that you have to pay your dues, you have to work hard in order to get what you want. And in a way, I view this, even though many people think this is a pretty common idea, but I thought there is one thing that is still missing among the written, among things that has been written by philosophers is, I view this as sort of a random chances. It's almost like probabilities. Once you have something bad happen, suddenly your chance of having another bad thing is going to be low, whereas your chance of having a good thing happen is going to be high. So that naturally we have something nice happen later on. So it's sort of like a fate. It's sort of like a God is coming in. You know, if you have suffered a lot, then God may come in to make sure you will have something good.
Something good.
Yeah. So some people will usually think this is cause and the result. You know, you work hard, therefore you naturally get that. But that's not necessarily true. I think it's something to do with the chance happening of things. So this idea of working hard and then get things in return, get rewards, that was in this writing of Monkfish's 2,000 years ago. That literally he says you have to starve to death, and before God, before heaven, something is going to put some real responsibility to you, or let you accomplish something real important. He's going to let you to work really hard and starve yourself to death and suffer. And I found my experience has been like that. And so that is actually very good in terms of having a positive outlook. So that when you're down, you don't really suffer that much. You always think something nice is going to happen. But then when you're very successful, then you need to be careful not to get excited too much. Then the next day, something bad is going to happen.
Disaster is just around the corner.
Yeah, right. So there's this Chinese philosopher, Tao, Taoism. Taoism consider everything should be natural. And if you're the peak, you're going to fall down more deeper than the average
I was also thinking a little bit back to when you were a child, and we talked about a little bit about your education and whatnot, but I was wondering what expectations your parents had for you and your brother in terms of what you would do, what you would achieve. Did they have expectations?
Well, in terms of myself, I first saw to myself and then my brother. For me, I always sort of a very determined person from the very young. So like I said, when I was at primary school, I started playing ping pong. And so I think my family was basically very supportive of whatever I chose to do. And I didn't really get the impression they specifically wanted me to become a ping pong player, for example. But if I work really hard on that, they also did not stop me. So I sort of always, then I changed to painting. And again, they were very supportive of that. And but of course, the regular academics because I was generally most of the time very good, so I also didn't get that impression that the parents was trying to push on that direction.
Right.
But I can tell if I'm doing poorly in the academics, probably my parents will not be happy.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the first example of that was when I came from Wuhan to Beijing to study in the Beijing school, and I was a little bit backward mm-hmm. in terms of my academic status
mm-hmm.
compared to my classmates mm-hmm. in the Beijing school, in the new school, and I wasn't able to memorize the numbers, times numbers, you know,
mm-hmm.
the basics, 3 times 3 equals 1, that kind of thing. And then I was really, the parents really just forced me to improve on that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think from that point of view, from that incident, you can tell they expect you to be good
mm-hmm.
with the schools. And so I kept, so even though I have all these extracurricular activities, my school academics at school are always good. And then for my brother, he was expected to learn something besides schools. Maybe the school academic was not so heavy and he had much, much more free time. So he was went to study violin for a while.
Mm-hmm.
I think that must be my parents' idea.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out he didn't like it that much. He didn't practice it very hard. So my parents also didn't push very hard in that
They direction. Didn't push.
No, mm-hmm. they didn't push. And so that's that. And then I think my parents was, again, very forceful in terms of this kid has to be good with academics. And
with your brother?
Yeah, with my mm-hmm. brother. So my brother was doing well before high school, as I told you.
Mm-hmm.
So he did that high school entrance test, did very well.
Mm-hmm.
So he moved up from this local middle school mm-hmm. where my home is close. He moved from this school to the high school in downtown Beijing, into one of the best high schools in Beijing.
So he did better than you did, because you stayed at the local school.
Yeah, but that was because in his time, there is this...
The chance of going to college.
The chance of going
now.
To college
yeah.
and also going to
yeah.
the key schools, they call.
Uh-huh.
So from his classes, they started this program again.
Mm-hmm.
So he was able to go to a good school, key
mm-hmm.
school. So he actually lived on campus and
mm-hmm.
just came home during the weekend
mm-hmm.
or something. So just like went to university in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
And then he started to play soccer and just playing with a lot of friends, and his
mm-hmm.
academic really dropped,
mm-hmm.
Maybe below average in his class.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes his test scores were so poor. So my parents were so concerned every time they will talk to my brother. And they even went to the high school to meet with the teachers to discuss what's going on. So
mm-hmm.
they were really concerned with that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But that is... I think, yeah, indeed, they do have some kind of expectation
mm-hmm.
that you need to perform well in school.
Mm.
But they are not like some parents like I saw here that really spend so much time with the kids in terms of helping them learning some skills,
mm-hmm.
some like figure skating or tennis, and
mm-hmm.
the parents, or soccer, and the parents actually have to go.
Mm-hmm.
with kids and spend a lot of time. I don't see my parents spending a lot of time, you know, trying to help me with painting or something,
mm-hmm.
right? So they pretty much leave us alone. Mm-hmm. Once we have an interest in something they think is useful or good, mm-hmm. then they leave us alone. They didn't mm-hmm. try to spend extra effort to cultivate that interest.
Right. Right. You know, here there's a lot of pressure on kids because you have to get into college and you have to get into grad school and there are all these things, whereas when you were growing up, there wasn't even the likelihood that you would get into college.
Right.
So do you think that, you know, your parents maybe were more relaxed with you than your brother because the situation was different? Or because you were more of a self-starter?
I think I'm more self-driven. They can see that. Mm-hmm. And my brother was not like me.
I see.
He's much more relaxed. And they can see that he's doing poorly in the school is simply because he's playing too much. He's not paying mm-hmm. attention. It's not because he's dumb or something.
Yeah.
So they need to just have to change his attitude.
Yeah.
For me, there's no attitude problem, uh-huh. so I don't need extra push in that regard.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I push myself already pretty crazy.
Yeah. Okay. You also mentioned that your dad was a workaholic. That was your word.
Yeah.
He was
traveling a lot. Even
oh,
when
he?
We were living in Beijing again, he was always working in some other provinces or cities, mm. in Shanghai, mm-hmm. so mm-hmm. always traveling.
So I wonder whether that was a trait that you inherited or not. Do you think you do the same
thing?
Yeah,
I think a little bit.
A little bit.
I think I consider myself not these days anymore, but when I was a student in high school or university or graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
Once I set my goal, I will just do everything I can to mm-hmm. achieve it. And I always felt panic or uneasy mm-hmm. if I found I have nothing to do.
Oh.
I like to be busy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Has having children changed that for you?
Having children changed a little bit. Yeah, I think I'm different from my father in terms of the relationship with the kid. Mm-hmm. I think I spend a lot more time with my kids now than he used to be with me.
Mm-hmm.
I realized once I had worked on something, for example, I have set up my lab and work on a project that I picked, and this lab would be the only lab in the world to work on this subject, and then it seems that working like crazy doesn't really get things done as expected. And sometimes it's a matter of time.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it's being patient and the result will come. When the situation not mature yet, no matter how hard you work, it's
mm-hmm.
not going to get done.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, I'm working on a stuff that is, you can say, not as competitive, so I don't have to really work 24 hours a day, so that if I don't work that way, then somebody else is going to find something.
Mm-hmm.
Or, we are not working on that kind of project.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then if at this point, it's either I'm going to make it in this way, or it's going to be too late for me to work on something else. And so I've been relaxing a little bit than before.
Okay. You know, you mentioned that your wife is also a scientist.
Right.
What does she do?
Okay, she was, as I said, in the same Cuspia student exchange program with the U.S., and so she had a very similar background as I had. So she also spent a year in the Guangzhou Center, and then she came to the U.S. to do graduate school in biochemistry, also same program. And she she went to she spent a longer time doing her PhD, so maybe 7 years. But she had two kids during that period, and then she did a postdoc at Salk Institute, and then she went to a local company called Vical, and Vical, V-I-C-A-L, for 2 or 3 years, and then she felt that the work there wasn't that challenging intellectually. So she then called up a friend, a colleague used to be at the SOC, at the same lab, and that colleague just started a company called Arena, also in San Diego. So she felt that a startup company is more exciting and more challenging and more financial payoff in the end. So she took a, so she joined that company. That's where she is now. Yeah. And so she's doing pretty well there. So she is pretty good in what she does. She's a very good scientist. And but we have felt that there's no way she's going to pursue academic work, academic job. Just it's going to be too demanding on the family. So even though she's very smart and very good, and she is more into the family.
Well, this actually brings up one of the questions that that I ask everyone actually, which is, you know, there's a big difference in graduate school and in postdocs. About half of the people are women, but when you look at the academic centers, the universities, it's about 5%.
Is that right? 5%?
Yeah, it's very low.
Actually, in our institute, there are a lot more.
Okay. Well, it's interesting because...
Are you saying, you know, especially in science, right? I don't think...
In science,
in history or literature.
Yeah, no, in science. And it varies from institution to institution, but it's...
Average.
But it's pretty low.
Okay.
And... So, you know, one of my questions is, you know, what happens to the women? So, in your family, it sounds like the two of you kind of made a decision that she shouldn't go that route.
Yeah. She probably doesn't want to go herself. She isn't that motivated to go in the beginning. I have met other women scientists who are much more determined. You know, to want to be an academic, sometimes even more determined than their husbands. But that usually is a personality issue, and you probably notice this also, that when you have a strong husband, generally the wife is less dominant. More family oriented rather than career oriented. That's how you can have a family between the two. They somehow natural selection to find each other attractive. Compromise. this is complementary. Whereas two career motivated person to have a family is going to be very tough. That's why you either find this family have a strong dominant husband or have a very strong dominant wife. And so what I've noticed is there are families that the wife is a professor. Mm-hmm. Sometimes even the husband also is a professor. But even in that case, when the wife is a professor, the wife is usually dominant in that relationship. Really? Yes. Mm-hmm. So I think this has a lot to do with the personality. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So in your family, I take it you're the dominant one.
Right.
Okay. So how does sort of the work of the family divide up?
The work is divided. I think I'm more into mechanical things like cars. Mm-hmm. And then my wife would take care of bills. Mm-hmm. And money issues, financial things, investment, which I'm not so much interested.
Yeah.
And also general house cleaning. Mm-hmm. And cooking. Mm-hmm. When she does cooking, then I usually does the dishwashing.
Mm-hmm. And how about with the kids? I mean, taking to school and taking to lessons and...
Taking to schools, I usually do it in the morning. Mm-hmm. And that's now what's going on. And before I either... Yeah, before it's like I take them to a school in the morning, and then she take them home. Mm-hmm. In the afternoon, because I usually work later.
Uh-huh.
And now it's going to be still this case, except now her parents are here.
Oh.
So the kids can go home right after school, about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. By bus.
Are they here permanently? Or
no, just for 1 year or so. Half
1 year.
Uh-huh. Okay. So that's how we divide it, and I would say she does a lot more housework than I do.
Okay. Some of the things that you said you liked to do when you were a kid, like painting and different sports things. Do you do those things still? Do you paint, for example?
No, not paint anymore. And I do sports. Mm-hmm. A lot. So I play tennis at least once or twice a week. Mm-hmm. I play in the San Diego local tennis league.
Oh,
uh-huh. I'm a level 4.5 or 5 player. 2 months ago, I hurt my ankle during a league match, so I haven't played for the last 2 months.
Uh-huh.
And about a year ago, I started playing golf.
Uh-huh.
And I enjoy that a lot. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm picking up golf very fast.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because I did well, and so I enjoy doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the golf and tennis are the two things I'm doing. Mm-hmm. Painting is basically it's going to take a lot of time, and I don't see where it's going to lead to.
Mm-hmm.
What's the purpose of doing it? If it's just for relaxing, then I'd rather go do some sports.
Mm-hmm.
And otherwise, I like to do things that's going to be enjoyable and also does some good.
Mm-hmm.
For my body or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So when I was painting, my goal was to become a professional or mm-hmm. something. Once that dream is done, then no more.
The way it went.
No more. And so okay. Unless in the future, after I retire, got mm-hmm. more time, then I may paint.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not going to just paint for the sake of painting. Probably I'm going to paint, and then this painting is going to be for something.
Mm-hmm.
either for sale or for something, mm-hmm. for exhibition, or mm-hmm. yeah, just not going to paint for myself to mm-hmm. enjoy. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Well, you know, you had mentioned earlier that you thought there was a relationship between art and math, mm-hmm. and you know, one of the things that I think about is that, you know, in order to really be a good scientist, you have to be creative.
Right. I think that's very true. I think the people with artistic talent, they are generally thinking in a more creative way and also doing things mm-hmm. in a more creative fashion. They do not like to do the very detailed routine kind of task. So that, even in painting, there are two different kinds of painting. One, especially in Chinese painting, there is this kind of more artistic but less detailed type of painting. And then there is this very craftsman-like type of painting mm-hmm. that every hair is mm-hmm. being drawer. Mm-hmm. So if you have 10,000 hair, it's going to take 10,000 brushes mm-hmm. to do it. But whereas the other type, just one brush, mm-hmm. that's your hair, it's done. Mm-hmm. And so I like, you know, this more wild type of painting, mm-hmm. and I don't like the other type, which is craftsman type. And then in my way of doing science, I also do not like to do the work that's going to fill in the details, mm-hmm. you know, for some existing topic mm-hmm. that somebody has opened up the field. Then I go in and just do some minor things to make the picture more complete. Mm-hmm. And so I rather do something that is I initiated, mm-hmm. so I take credit for, and that's something new. Something has not been done before, mm-hmm. and then that gets me motivated to do mm-hmm. it. And in fact, that's what I have been doing since graduate school. So the first project was like that. I feel very excited about mm-hmm. that idea and pursued it for 2 years. Even though it didn't pan out, I still kept that kind of work habit or something.
And that was the RNA.
That was the RNA, mm-hmm. yeah. And of course, I for finishing the degree's sake, I did something just for the sake of doing mm-hmm. it, to get a paper out. So I did that. And then during the postdoc period, I also, first entering the lab, I took a project that was given to me. So that has not too much to do with my interest or not. Lab wants to do it, so I did it. But I saw this has a good chance of not working. So I thought of something that I can do, and then I did it. So two ideas, and they both worked. So that leads to two papers from the postdoc, and then after I started my lab here. The general direction I still followed, which is to clone and study the proteins which can bind to the RB tumor suppressor. At the time I started, none of them has been isolated, although mm-hmm. it's been proven to be present, but mm-hmm. one needs to clone them. Mm-hmm. So that's what I started doing. Mm-hmm. And then I indeed cloned several genes that one of them is particularly interesting from the structure. And I thought that one was really the protein people were looking for. And then it turned out there are other peoples who cloned something which is people are looking for that was turned out to be the correct thing, the E2F. And so my thing didn't turn out to be that protein which I was expecting to. And, but it has itself some interesting characteristics, which I think is going to be interesting and important. So I went ahead, just focused my lab working on this gene. And
which gene is that?
This is the RIZ, the zinc finger gene. And pretty much then I do not have much interaction with the rest of the field who works on E2F. So I'm pretty much in my own little world of this gene, which I cloned, patented, and try to make a name by working with this. And so that is we have been doing for the last 8 years, all around this gene and the related families, the family members of this gene. So we, when we discovered this gene, we also discovered a new family, a new protein motif. So a number of things are exciting about this. And gradually we realized this gene is, in the beginning we didn't know what this gene is in terms of role in tumor genesis. We were still pursuing its interaction with the RB protein. Although at the time the RB function is pretty much thought to be mediated by this E2F protein that other labs have cloned. And so there are the dominant idea that RB and E2F. And for RIZ to somehow play a role in RB function, we still think there is a role for RIZ. However, it has been very difficult to establish that role. Thing may have something to do with our protein being present in very, very low amount in the cell. It's very difficult to work with. It's a very large protein. And so we're really lacking a lot of reagents that can get something done easily. So that in the role in RB is still not clear at this point. But slowly, gradually, we realize another aspect of this gene could be even more interesting. That is, we want to establish RIZ as itself an important tumor suppressor gene. So, and that turned out to be the case, slowly. And we now really have some solid evidence to say this is an important tumor suppressor. Although the papers are being submitted or being published at this moment for the final evidence to come out. So before this, we have published papers in Cancer Research, JBC, to suggest such a role in tumor suppression. But we, those papers do not have the solid, the convincing evidence that the field is going to accept this concept.
Now, one of the things you gave me, or you sent me to read, I think the title of it was The Yin and the Yang. Is that the article that you're talking about that's going to come out?
No, that was still that was a review paper. Just summarizing what we have published before. And so that one doesn't really have, you know, all the existing literature right now on RIZ, on what we have published. None of those have the missing genetic data that people are looking for to say whether this is a tumor suppressor or not. So what we have now is the data with which we are lots of meeting right now. And one of them, I think, is IMPRESS, in collaboration with another scientist, that we found indeed RIS is mutated in human colon cancer and gastric cancer. Oh. And we also have found its mutation in human non-Hodgkin's lymphoma.
Non-Hodgkin's lymphoma.
Mm-hmm. And furthermore, we have done the knockout mice.
Mm-hmm.
And we inactivated RIS1, and these mice developed tumors.
So that should convince
mm-hmm. the other people.
Mm-hmm.
And so that should make our life a little bit easier mm-hmm. to go out and say why we are studying this gene.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Before, I have some difficulty justifying, you know, why you study this. You haven't shown it's important, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, I know you had said just a few minutes ago that you're doing something that no one else is doing in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of brings up the whole question of competition in the sciences, because it sounds like you're not really competing with anybody at the moment.
Yeah.
But in a lot of areas, there's tremendous competition,
right.
You know, to get work done, to publish, to
right.
be first.
Right.
To, are you just, I mean, did you just fall into something that isn't competitive, or is it your nature not to want to be in a competitive situation?
Actually, my nature is like to compete.
Uh-huh.
That is how I end up in this postdoc lab doing
mm-hmm.
the RB stuff.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, the RB field was very competitive. The
mm-hmm.
lab I was in was one of the three labs that cloned this gene.
Mm-hmm.
So you can imagine all these labs are competing with one another to do this work. And so I wasn't afraid of that. And I did it.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much in a timely fashion. And it's kind of interesting you mentioned competition. Both of my papers have similar papers from other groups publishing about the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So the EMBO paper has
uh-huh.
Another lab from Cosmic Harbor had a similar paper in EMBO.
Mm-hmm.
And then my paper in Nature
mm-hmm.
was also either followed or about the same time
uh-huh.
by another paper from Harvard Medical School that was published in Cell. So you can see my postdoc work was competitive work.
Mm-hmm.
And then once I started the lab, the work I started doing was also competitive, which is to clone the proteins that RB combines to.
Mm-hmm.
Our Nature paper demonstrated such proteins exist
mm-hmm.
in the cell, and now it's a question of studying what they are.
Mm-hmm.
So that was basically what this RB field, everybody in this RB field, is doing
mm-hmm.
to clone those proteins. And now it's been like, there must be like 40 proteins.
Mm-hmm.
That was identified to bind to RB. So you can say that field was also quite competitive. The reason that I end up not being competing is because the gene that I cloned turned out to be something that nobody else is working on.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that it is an interesting gene, has some potential to be important. So I think it's worth to devote my effort to work on this gene.
Mm-hmm.
Compared to working on E2F, for example, which would be a hot topic, which would be competitive, because a lot of people is going to work on that. It's obviously important.
Mm-hmm.
I do not feel that the potential reward for me is going to be greater than the if I stay with my own gene. Why? Because this again goes to the question of doing the work just to fill the details. So basically, the guy has cloned A2F1. So if I didn't clone it and I started working on it, there's no way, there could be a small chance happening that I can do something great that will overtake the original discoverer of E2F. But most likely, that's not going to happen. And so no matter how hard and how many good papers I can get of this, in terms of your accomplishments in the history point of view, few people is going to remember, you know, one of the 100 people who work on E2F to add something to the story.
I need to change the tape over.